My name is Drew Daniels, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya, look at you. You're getting like blasted with sunlight there. What's going on?
I know it's weird because it's overcast and sunny at the same time. There seems to be a light beam just streaming through this window. It's
trying to
not
get you.
Like a,
they're trying to take you
it's
out.
It's not a bright sunny day, but yeah, it's a thing. So, and how are you, sir? How is life and things in the great city of angels?
Well, especially great because I got to see you last week.
That's right.
And
I was just there.
Yeah. You had your customer appreciation day, and something happened to me there that's never happened in my entire life. I won a raffle at Hot Rod Cameras. And for our YouTube viewers, you can see what I won. It is a tiny red camera that I was like, wow, I won a camera? No. Oh, yeah. It looks like it's got like a lamp or something. Is it a lamp or a flashlight? No.
No.
It's basically a paperweight. But what's cool is that it has this lens here for ASMR people. Here's.
Yeah, little C-mat
like
lens,
I can bring this to set and accidentally drop it in front of people and watch DPs and camera assistants have a heart attack.
It really looks like the type of thing you'd get out of a gacha, machine in Japan or something. You'd put like 100 yen in or 500 yen.
If camera shops had claw machines, but this is heavy. I mean, like you could bludgeon someone to death with this. I mean, like
it's machined out of aluminum. Yeah,
listen,
that's right.
Listen to it again. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
Very satisfying sound. To me, it's been a fidget toy. I've been sitting here unscrewing and rescrewing the lens onto the body of it and pressing all the buttons that don't do a damn thing. Hey, Ilya, who's on the show today?
Hey, Drew Daniels is on the show. I did an interview with him recently about Anora. He is the DP of Anora and also Red Rocket. He's got a long, a career now working with Sean Baker. And it's a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed this movie.
And that movie's getting some love. It just got a bunch of love at the Golden Globe nominations. And I know every year we make fun of the Golden Globes, but still.
Should we make fun of them again?
Of course we will. No. I mean, it's the most meaningless awards ceremony ever, but any award is good. And I do think it's a precursor. I think I will be surprised if that movie's not nominated for Best Cinematography, if not Best Picture.
Yeah, and you know what? The Golden Globes don't do a cinematography award, so they're on my list. They're on my list. You know, it's like,
I'm in the Gotham Awards.
The Gotham Awards.
There's no reason the Golden Globes shouldn't have a cinematography category, except that, they want all the glamour pusses in front of the cameras and cinematographers are behind the cameras.
Yeah, it's a huge oversight, and Golden Globes will stay on my shit list forever because of that, until they change their ways. And especially since they have new ownership now and they're trying to turn over new leaves, this would be an opportunity to actually do something, but no.
They should put you on the advisory board of the cinematography award.
Hey, I volunteered before. They didn't pay any attention to me. I'm not a member of the Hollywood Foreign Press, so there you go.
I mean,
we're
who,
not exactly.
But who is?
We're not. Yeah, exactly. 82 people is the answer to that. 82 people are members of that.
And now, close focus.
So Ben, what do we have to yak about in our close focus today? What is what's going on in the world of cinema?
This jumped out at me, and it's something that just literally dropped yesterday as we're talking, because you and I have had several conversations on here about I think we're on not entirely different wavelengths about this, but I'm like, hey, I don't care if you shoot on your phone. If that's the camera you have, I don't think you would disagree with that. Hey, if the only camera you have is your phone, go make a short film on your phone, go make a movie on your phone. But notoriously, Danny Boyle and friend of the show Anthony Dodd Mantle have made a sequel to 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later. They skipped 28 Months Later, went straight to 28 Years Later, and they shot it on the iPhone. And the trailer dropped, I believe, yesterday. And I watched the trailer, and I was like, God damn, that looks great. Now, the original 28 Days Later also shot on consumer-grade gear or prosumer-grade gear. It was shot on the Canon XL1 on a PAL K Canon XL1. And I actually went to Sundance, and I was at Sundance when that movie premiered, and it blew my mind. And it was one of the first times I'd ever seen it. I think, or I'd ever seen digital video
kind of
blown out. It was kind of a thing that was happening a lot. We're coming out of the Dogma 95 movement. Films like The Celebration, which were shot on digital video, were kind of a big deal, which also, by the way, was shot by Anthony Dodd Mantle. And he's gone on to shoot so many amazing things. I just think he's an inspirational fella. But I'm curious, because you just watched the trailer, but we have not even discussed it. I'm curious what your first impressions are. Would it have shown up on your radar at all as, oh, I bet this was shot on a phone?
Maybe. I haven't seen the movie, and the trailer is little clips and a lot of darkness, a lot of fade up, a lot of fade down, fade up, fade down. So they don't give you a lot of time to really
see. A lot of drone shots, which I also assume are probably not phones.
Probably not. Now, I think this really, really underscores, though, because, of course, when you watch this trailer, it looks good. But again, it is just goes to show that it's who is using the tool is so much more important than the tool itself. And I can't. This is the thing that I think a lot of people get caught up on. Oh, they used this tool. That means I own that tool. And when I go to do it, it's going to look the same, or I have the same capabilities. And this, the straight answer is not. You are not Anthony Dodd Mantle. You're not working with a multi-million dollar budget. You are grinding out the
best. Wait, why are you looking right at me when you say that? Come on, man.
No, I'm speaking figuratively here, but here's the other thing too. The choice to use the phone did not make Anthony Dodd Mantle's life easier. It just didn't. And, you know, we haven't talked about this. We haven't had him back on the show to discuss the matter. But the thing about purpose-built tools is they are built for a purpose, and an iPhone isn't that. An iPhone is made to be like an everything thing, and one of the things it has is a camera. And yes, you can make really good images with all kinds of consumer cameras. And I'm not going to tell tales out of school, but I'm aware of sort of like the brain trust that went into talking about how to make the iPhone work for Anthony Dodd Mantle. We know some of the same people. And look,
rhyme with Schmeichel Schmione by any chance?
No, okay. I don't know if he would talk to him at all, but someone else.
First guy I talked to. Anyway.
And so they called me and were like, hey, you know, what arguments can you give me to help bolster my claim as to why maybe this shouldn't be the right thing? And so I said, look, there are plenty of other consumer tools. If the idea is that it's a consumer tool that will make the job easier, there are plenty of like small format Sony cameras, as proven by the creator, which could absolutely work for this and deliver not just arguably, actually measurably better images, like from a technical standpoint. Now, artistically, it's still going to depend on who's using it. And so Anthony Dodd Mantle is supremely talented. He is, you know,
one of the best.
Incredibly. Yeah.
Hands down, one of the best.
So talented. So,
and also somebody who is not afraid to try out whatever technology will get the job done, you know, as, you know, like I always think about what he did on Slumdog Millionaire, Oscar-winning film.
Slumdog Millionaire is a perfect example. And he was really working with untested technology at that time.
What was the name of that camera? It doesn't even...
SI2K. Yeah. Silicon Imaging. Yeah. 2K camera. Yeah.
Which sounded at the time like science fiction and now sounds like every camera you can use.
Yeah. I mean, one of the configurations for that camera is it's tethered to a laptop. So it's like, it wasn't exactly... Like, he has made movies where things are not easy. Yeah. And so I think... probably compared to the SI2K, it might have been easier. But that being said, a lot of the interface, working with lenses, his focus puller's jobs definitely weren't easier. And I'm sure that they were probably using a depth of field adapter of some sort, which is similar to what they used on the earlier 28 Days Later. So look, it's an achievement, no doubt. But I think that before the very uninformed mainstream press goes, here it is, everyone can go shoot a 28 years later on their phone, which is what will happen. Guarantee you people are going to be on Reddit going about how I can go make 28 years later. So it's like,
well, I mean, look, the truth is, yeah, you can go make a film on your phone. Like you can do it if you have the newer. I mean, like I think it was when the iPhone 14 came out.
Sean Baker did it all these years ago.
Well, he did it with the iPhone 6 with Tangerine in one Sundance. And then just a few years ago, Steven Soderbergh made a movie called Unsane that was shot on the iPhone. And I remember, I think it was when the iPhone 14 was announced, they had a demo that was shot by Greg Fraser and directed by Kathryn Bigelow. And it looked amazing. And again, I think I've probably talked on here about how on Strata's YouTube channel, Michael Cioni kind of shows how they outfitted an iPhone to be used as a cinema camera and how they were able to kind of achieve cinema-like results. And they did like basically a side-by-side with a Red. Not with this Red, though. Not with my little mini Red.
I will tell you that producers love the idea of saving money, and I don't blame them. It is part of their job description to be thrifty and to maximize the budget. So when they think that the thing that they've got in their pocket could, you know, substitute all the line items that represent, you know, the camera technology on a movie, you're going to get a bunch of people who are asking for it or asking for to do the same thing. 28 years later is going to perpetuate that, and I am going to continue to advise all the people who seek my counsel on this that it is a bad idea for 99.9% of people. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be people who are going to try it and do it, and I'm sure the iPhone will get more love, there will be more things shot on it, but still, compared to the $2,000 essentially webcam that I'm using right here, the Sony ZV-E1, the ZV-E1 would make someone's life much easier, and the iPhone does not.
So I agree, and also, like, you know, talking, and it's not even really that much cheaper if you're buying the phone just for production. Like, I think an iPhone just by itself, like the Pro Max one, I think will run you about $1,500 or $2,000 anyway. So it's not like you're saving that much money.
Before lens adapters, before professional cinema lenses, stuff.
My whole thing is, like, if this is what you got, use it. You know, like, no shame.
Absolutely.
No shame in it. And on the flip side, too, when you talk about how we're probably going to see lots of ads, it reminds me of when Steven Soderbergh used the XL1 again on Full Frontal, a movie that he made, I want to say.
Partially.
In, like, 2001. Well, it was... like I saw were ads of the XL1 with him, you know, holding an XL1 on his arm. And then I saw the movie, and the movie was almost like a commercial for how much better film looked, because it XL, like, unlike 28 Days Later, which is going for a gritty, grimy, you know, it's embracing it as an aesthetic. Full Frontal, like cuts,
contrasts it.
Beautiful 35 millimeter cinematography against, like, not great looking XL1 footage.
And this is exactly right. When you have no point of reference, it becomes very hard to tell what is good or what is not good. And movies that do this, such as, there was an awful lot of people who said, yes, you know, 28 Days Later was a gritty look. But, you know, without that point of reference, they might not actually realize how gritty it was compared to 35 millimeter. Steven Soderbergh gave everyone that. He gave it to them in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
So. Yeah. Anyway,
it could be looking like this. It's going to look like this now.
Anyway, so. If you're hearing us, check out the trailer for 28 Years Later and, you know, let us know what you think.
Yeah, please do. All right, let's get to the interview with Drew Daniels.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Hey, I'm joined now by Drew Daniels, cinematographer of the new hit movie, Anora. Hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Very proud of this movie and of everything that it's achieved so far. It's amazing.
You should be. It's great. It's a really good movie. I got to see it on it was definitely the Portland premiere, but it was the, like, a 35 millimeter print here in Portland in the largest 35 millimeter screen here, which was a packed, completely sold out crowd. And the audience absolutely loved Anora. It was a tremendous, tremendous reaction. How has your experience been seeing this with audiences? How does it feel for you?
You know, usually I get sick of watching the same movie over and over again. I mean, I've shot the movie, graded the movie, watched it for a week straight, every single day, watched it down multiple times, watched it at Cannes, watched it at the LA premiere. I just watched it the other day in front of my friends and family. I did, like, a private screening for them, and I don't get sick of it. I really do. I love this film. I'm so proud of it, and I feel like I pick up on new things that I love about it and things that I don't love about it every single time I watch it. I'm very, it's so watchable. And I think it gets better the more you watch it. And like, you keep thinking about it. That's what I really appreciate. And I appreciate all the people that have reached out to me. There's so many people, I more than any other project I've ever worked on. And people reach out and they tell me how much it means to them and how much they just can't shake the film. It sticks with you, you know, especially the ending.
You first came on my radar when I saw Red Rocket a few years back, and I really enjoyed Red Rocket, and that was a very polarizing movie. I met people who liked it very much like me and people who were like, what the hell am I watching? So, but I thought it really had a POV, it really had a perspective, and I really appreciated what the movie was doing. Can you talk a little bit about your, you know, the early collaboration? Because, of course, you reteamed with Sean Baker again for this. You guys won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. I mean, amazing. Can you, in the early days of like Red Rocket, could you kind of foresee where your you know, where the path was going to take you and your future collaborations? Take me back a little bit.
Well, I've been a fan of Sean Baker for years. So I mean, it's been a dream to work with him. I mean, as any cinematographer dreams of working with their favorite directors, it's just, you know, it's like a lifetime goal. It's an artistic goal. So I also knew that it would be a good fit. I just felt it, you know, like watching Florida Project, Tangerine, Starlet. Like I just felt like his sensibilities, the humanity, the humanism, the empathy behind the images. I just felt like we had such a similar point of view, or just a similar like ethos behind our filmmaking approach. So you know, I got the call for Red Rocket, and in so many ways Red Rocket was just like right up my alley. And it was also a return for me to Texas, where I went to film school. It just checked all the boxes, you know. And then I find out more about the film. Like, oh, this is like a very low budget film. It's going to be like a documentary sized crew. And you know, on one hand, that's terrifying. But like, I also love to choose projects that are terrifying. Like for me, that's one of the criteria. So, you know, it just felt right. I grew up going to that beach in Galveston, you know, where we were staying and where we were shooting. And I went to film school in Texas, learned how to shoot on 16. So for me, it was just like almost serendipitous. Like it felt like a full circle. And like, this is what I'm meant to do right now. And I mean, of course I said yes before I even read the script. And then I read it and I was like, oh my God, what am I getting myself into? But I mean, in every single way, it was amazing. It was probably the hardest film I've ever worked on. I mean, just summer, Texas, you're doing everything yourself. Very grueling, but creatively, I just learned that I really respected Sean. We're so in sync, and it just felt like a match made in heaven, you know?
Yeah. That's really interesting to me. So jump forward a little bit in time and tell me about getting the call then for this. Was it like, I mean, Sean's famous for, you know, not necessarily being the most conventional filmmaker, for really trying to do things differently. And when you got the call, was it like, I'm getting the band back together, it's going to be Red Rocket Part 2? Or was it like, no, we got a bigger budget, we're doing more? How did that go?
Well, I was kind of, it wasn't really like getting a call, because I knew about it from the almost the inception of it. I know that he's been thinking of this idea for like 15 years or something. With Karin, this Brighton Beach film, you know, set in the Russian community. But it was not that long after Red Rocket, I think maybe he was even still editing, and we started talking about Anora. Started talking about just like, I think he pitched a couple of different film ideas, and Anora was like the one that was kind of the most developed and the most exciting too. And then right from the beginning, I feel like before the script was even fully written, he was involving me. We were doing tests. We were going out to Brighton Beach. We were, we were just already in talks about like, what the look of this film might be, what the palette of it might be. So I was just there from the beginning in a sense. Like me and Coco, like right from the start, we're just part of it. And I love that Sean really cherishes and values his collaborators like that. You don't really get that kind of a relationship with directors that often, you know, that include you. He includes me in the edit too. He includes me in you know, early scouts, like sort of like a research scouts, you know. I mean, much earlier than you would involve a cinematographer traditionally. So, and that's like, yes, amazing. Sean, yeah, it's amazing.
I think you're making a lot of other DPs jealous right now because it's like, you know, often people
get the trade-off though. Yeah. There's a trade-off because it's not conventional, like you were saying. It's not a conventional shoot. It's not a conventional prep. Once the prep actually starts, that's not conventional. Like we're not sitting in an office shot listing all day. Like we didn't even shot list Anora. Like we started to shot list the home invasion sequence and we did that for a couple days and we didn't really get very far and we just realized this is not going to be the best use of time. We just need to get on the same page. We just need to like meld our minds further. Scout. I mean, all scouting. Like we scouted and scouted and while we're scouting, we're blocking the scenes out. We're photographing it with ourselves. So in a way that's like a shot list. We never refer to any of those again, you know, you just kind of go through the process and you store it away deep in your psyche. And then it's something that you just sort of have as a base for other ideas to spawn from.
Tell me a little bit more about the, like, well, first of all, I'm a little bit blown away because like the home invasion is like, it's a big chunk of the movie. There's a lot that goes on there and it's not uncomplicated with multiple people and stunts and things happening. So, and fight choreography. So, okay. But beyond all that, let's just take a half step back. Mind melding. What process do you go through for the mind meld? Are you like watching movies together? Are you saying like, this is something that really I respond to? Are you referencing are you putting together like little pitch decks? So, I mean, are you just having a beer? What's the mind meld process?
It's more like the latter, more just like having a beer, more just spending time driving around in a car and you just inevitably talk about the movie, you know? We talk about like, oh, what this scene could maybe be this. Like, oh, I saw this thing the other day. It reminds me of this. You know, that plus like getting excited while we're scouting and then bringing those ideas into the film. Also, when we're scouting, we're also casting, you know, so that's part of it. Like when we're scouting Red Rocket, we would literally pull up in the car at a stoplight next to another car. And we would look at someone and be like, hey, maybe she'd be our Lil. And tell them to roll down the window. And we'd hand them a card and be like, we're casting a movie. We're shooting. Like that happens like just driving while we're scouting. That's how we actually found our Lil for Red Rocket. Just the most serendipitous run in with her. It was amazing. Sean went to go to the bathroom to go pee. And then at a porta potty that was next to the plant, next to the refinery, and like opens the door. And Lil and Brenda was right there in his face like, hey, I need to jump. My battery's dead. And Sean is like, okay, wait here. And Sean rushes back to the house and he's like, hey man, I think we found Lil. I found her. I was in the porta potty and she was there and I gotta go give her a jump. And that's how we casted Lil, or Brenda as Lil. And I mean, that's kind of how a lot of the casting happens. You know, you find people introduce you to one person who introduces you to a cousin who introduces you to like a friend who or a bar owner. And we get locations like that. We get talent that way. Although this Anora was much more professionally casted. I mean,
yeah, it
was a professional cast mostly, you know.
Anora doesn't have the same feel as Red Rocket. It feels much higher budget. It feels more methodical and planned out in the way that things are put together. I mean,
well, and I also remember when we were shooting, when I was watching Red Rocket in the premiere or at a screening in New York City, I was watching it and I was like, man, we need to shoot on 35 anamorphic. Mm-hmm. Like there's just something about the 16. I'm like, this is, it's beautiful, but like
It's a grungy format. Yeah.
It still has that, a little bit of that grunge. It still doesn't pop and like snap the way that like 35 millimeter just grabs onto something. It grabs onto the images pop off the screen in a way. And, yeah, I was just thinking, man, 35, we got to shoot 35 for the next one. Like, I love this, but it just needs a little something. But so Anora is different than a lot of Sean's films, because Sean's films often deal with people who are like on the fringes, or people who are in a certain socioeconomic standing, and
fringes of society, and never looks down at them.
Anora takes on the oligarch, wealth, opulence. Mm-hmm. You know, so like 35 Anamorphic just felt like it needed to be a bigger, more magical format, something that will fully embrace like the scope of that mansion, and like it just felt right, you know.
I would say though, yes, you've got the wealthy aspect, but you still have fringes, you still have, you know, sex workers, and you have gangsters, sure, and you have all this stuff who are not necessarily, it's, you know, it's not Ozzy and Harriet, it's not like, you know, it's not, well, it's not, well, yeah,
but that's also something that Sean likes to do, and something I also like to do is not to shoot poverty, you know, 16 millimeter grainy handheld with like spherical lenses. No, it's like shoot it in a way that shows the beauty, that emphasizes like the humanity, and like for them this is beautiful, this is their life, this is all they know. So it's not like gringy, like everything's desaturated, tinted blue or whatever, you know. It's like, no, let's saturate the world, let's show it how they see their world, let's show it in a slightly more, I don't really say objective, because like Sean's world is like a mixture of objective with subjective, you know, and like, choosing to shoot anamorphic and choosing to shoot with that depth of field and those old beautiful Lomo lenses, it gives it this velvet, beautiful quality, like a fine bottle of wine or something, you know. It's just like this elegance, you know, it's elegant. So you're shooting this story that's a little down, but it's, you're shooting in an elegant, elevated format and look and feel, you know.
Did I hear correctly that the movie was flashed like in camera? You were using a Vericon, or you're using
we did partially use the Vericon. I really wish I could have flashed the whole negative, pre-flashed it, but. Mm. Because one of my like rules going into it, one of the things, you know, we watched Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, me and Sean, mm-hmm. and
sure,
there's just something about the almost like the ethos of that film. It just felt like they were just doing whatever they could to shoot in available light in New York City, in the subways, in the cars, in the platforms, in the police stations. I'm sure they're lighting too, but it just felt like the negative was just starving for light and just struggling to exist almost, you know? And I love that. It has this feeling that like a lot of 70s cinema feels, where you're just starting to go out and shoot in the streets, you know, and shoot in real locations and shoot with available nighttime lights. So you're seeing New York, you're seeing the actual light of New York. And I really wanted that for this film, and I wanted it to not feel perfect, and you know, so therefore we're like just dollying right on the floor, you know, or there are bumps, there are, we're on the carpet, we're on the floor, we have a little bit of like, we embrace some of those mistakes, what we might normally think of as mistakes, you know.
Now, the movie feels, I mean, it's a movie, it's a work of fiction, but it feels real in a lot of it. And there's probably nothing less real, I would say, to the audience maybe, than having those super sort of like stylizations of like, you know, anamorphic out of focus backgrounds and all of the different sorts of wonderful bits of cinematography that make something beautiful to look at. But that's not reality. But because it's sort of grounded in this, like, I want to say sort of like retro film, sort of 1970s aesthetic a little bit, but it feels very East Coast. It feels modern. It feels like, but there's this patina of like movies that you used to see, which I feel like it was super intentional. The movie's gorgeous, but it also, despite being a work of fiction, has this sort of like retro realness to it. And I mean, how would you describe that?
Well, I would just say that the film kind of in a way feels like Annie as a character, or Anora, you know, that the movie's called Anora. So I wanted it to also have a bit of her personality. You know, it has this, what is it? She has like this, it has attitude, you know, like mm-hmm. it has attitude. It has like that scrappiness, you know, that she has. And I wanted the film to also echo that. And also, I mean, it just looks like the films that I love, you know, like I love 70s cinema. I love New York films. Every cinematographer gets their shot. At least most of them do at like their New York film, right? Like you get a shot at it. Like what? And for me, this was like my New York film. This was like, I wanted to look like my favorite New York films, but like also have a bit of me and also have a bit of Annie and also have a bit of Sean. And like, it's kind of just an amalgamation of all those things. And also like Sean is very much like a social realist filmmaker, right?
Yeah.
But Sean doesn't like shooting the films in a social realist way. I think that like that's where we embed like a little style, a little bit of flair, a little bit of personality, a little bit of subjectivity to it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it makes it special, you know?
I really enjoy watching the progression of Sean too. I feel like, his latest movies are the ones that I like the best, actually. I really appreciate sort of like his evolution as a filmmaker. There is one shot in this movie which is distinctive because I can't, at least from my memory, can't think of another helicopter shot from a Sean Baker film. But there's clearly like a big zoom helicopter pull out sort of like moment where you've get like, you know, the New York skyline in the background. Can you talk about that? Because that's like, it's worth mentioning.
Oh, you mean the handheld helicopter shot in 2024?
Yes.
In a major motion picture? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
that's Sean. I mean, that was all Sean. Like, I got to say, like, there were a lot of different camps on that shot. It was like, we all knew we needed the shot. We wanted it to feel big. We wanted it to reveal the context of where that apartment or that mansion was in relationship to Manhattan. Because as you zoom out and then pull back and boom up, you see Manhattan in the background and you get a little flare, you get the sunset. It's like, it's really beautiful. But we were like, okay, we can do this on a drone, but we were having trouble affording and finding like a drone that we could do on film. Also, we wanted to shoot it with our anamorphic lenses. So it was the same lenses. We wanted to use this anamorphic zoom. So that was every step along the way was like excluding, like it was just not going to work on a drone.
Ooh, did you have the old Lomo or Photon anamorphic zoom?
We did.
Oh yeah.
Amazing zoom.
That's a crazy lens.
It is a crazy lens. So Sean just kept on saying, I want to shoot this shot handheld. Like, I don't care. Like, it's going to be shaky. It's going to whatever. Like, I want to shoot it handheld. And we were like, okay. And then a guy kind of got excited about it. You know, I was like, all right, let's fucking do it. We're going to do it. And then the guy who did the helicopter stuff, he actually had a digital camera on the nose mount as like a backup. Mm. But we never even rolled it. I mean, we basically just opened the door. We had this this guy, his name is Moose. He was a first AC and he was doing the operating on it because I could send him out there to do. I couldn't go out there to do it. It would have taken me hours to get to the launch pad, shoot it, hours back. I would have been gone from set all day because it was a shoot day. So we had Moose do it. And I mean, of course, we needed a guy called Moose because he's huge. And this is like a 50-pound camera with a huge zoom lens. And he's hand-holding it, zooming out. And then as the camera, you know, the helicopter lifts up and pulls back, all that inertia, and he's just holding on for dear life. And you know, like at the end of the day, we didn't think we had it. We got kicked out by the aviation from the airport.
Whoa. Okay.
They came in and they were like, hey, they radioed us like, hey, you guys are too close to the airport. You got to get out of there.
Oh no.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, we had to kind of pull the plug a little before we felt good about it. And it was really shaky. We were really having a hard time getting the shot. So we waited till the next day or so. We saw the dailies. We sent it to our colorist to stabilize a little bit. And in the end, it was great. You know, and it's a little rocky. It's rough. It looks and feels how it should feel for the film. And it stands out because nobody is doing that. And Sean was totally right. You know, Sean is very right in most of those scenarios. And often the way Sean wants to do it is way, way harder, way more time consuming, way more risky, everything, you know, but it's always better and it's always the right choice. Sean just has that innate, he just knows, he has that ability, you know.
It's a much funnier movie than I would have expected going in. There's a lot of good, dark laughs in this movie. And for me, that was, I'm assuming for you too, it's one of the most satisfying things about seeing a movie in a crowded theater is when like a funny moment just hits and the audience has that reaction. Can you talk about the humor a little bit? Was the humor on the page? Is the humor found on the day? How does the humor integrate with all of this?
I mean, there was some humor on the page, but I gotta say our actors were just so good and so funny. Like Mark Edelstein, who plays Yvonne, like, oh my God, he brought way more humor. He tripled the amount of humor that he brought that character to life. And Garnick, of course, Garnick is hilarious. Vache. I mean, really, everybody like amped up the humor. Even Iger, you know, like
Oh yeah, he's great. Yeah,
he's funny too. Like everybody, I felt like once it started going, everybody was like one upping each other on like how much humor and comedy they could bring into it. But I love that it has so much humor because like life is funny, and like even in the most, you know, screwed up scenarios, like there's always humor, and humor brings people together, and there's. And you need that. I think I like also films that are able to do that and don't take themselves too seriously. Because like even in our film, when you start to get really serious, it's like kind of subverted by some like ridiculous comedy moment that just, you know, it just kind of like re-energizes the audience. You know, the audience stays very energized throughout the film, which I was very pleasantly, you know, happy with.
Yeah, and Annie is such a fearless character. Her character is just doesn't matter the situation. Like, even if she is afraid, you'd never know it because, you know, she's just so confident in all of these, you know, ridiculous situations. And even when, you know, she's clearly dealing with, you know, serious threats, she keeps her head about herself. She is a dynamic person for the audience to latch onto. I mean, can you talk a little bit about just sort of the discussion of, you know, how you portray Annie in this? Is, I mean, are you thinking constantly about how do we, Annie is, even when she's not in control, she feels like she's in control. And that's kind of amazing. And I feel like visually there's a real trick. There's a real trick to that. Is this stuff that you're talking about with Sean? Is this stuff that you're figuring out? Is it more intuitive? Is it kind of, how do you do it in the moment? What's that like?
I mean, it's a little bit of all of that. Yeah. It's intuitive. It's in the moment, but we talk about it constantly. Sean is very aware of, you know, he's very visual and we both talk about the edit a lot every single day, every single scene. We're talking about how it's going to cut. What is the energy of the scene before? Like literally every aspect of the rhythm, the pacing, the cutting. How are we going to get in this scene? What is the sequence of cuts in the sequence, in the scene? But also like what you're saying about just tracking Mikey and what she's thinking, like her sort of command of the scenes and the character. I mean, that's all her, but the camera is also trying to sort of echo her mental state or her psychological state or emotional state for any given moment, you know. Like for instance, during my cat. Also during the during the home invasion scene, for instance, we start that off very static, very controlled. Then the camera starts moving as like the knocks at the door, like there's this progression. There's like a little bit of tension, lenses get longer. The camera's like playing between the dynamics. She's sort of losing control. It's spinning out. Then by the time she gets thrown onto the couch and they're ripping the ring off of her, Toros shows up. Brings in handheld, you know. She's losing control of the scenario. It's going handheld. And then she's tied up at the end. She's gagged. Now it's like a reset and we're back static. Like every shot is dead still, you know. So like you know, you could shoot that a million different ways, but like we wanted to have that progression and have this sort of language that echoed her control of the scene, her control of the scenario, her emotional state as well. And then I think there's a shot upstairs in the mirror, you know, right afterwards where we're zooming on that Lomo zoom. And it's like just a breath where you're checking in on her after this scene. And it's very short. It's like she washes her face, looks in the mirror, time to go. And then Igor's in the doorway and there's like a kind of a laugh there. But yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about the tracking of our character, the language as it relates to her, you know, and her emotional state.
Yeah,
very important for us, you know.
Oh, I feel like it's everything. It's what the audience engages in. It's what, yeah. You know, it's are you invested in these characters? Are you invested in what's happening? And that's, you know, there's so many ways to screw that up, but you know, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in this movie. It's you know, it's the hero. It's like you're invested. I felt that I was invested from moment one, which is amazing. Hey, you know what? I want to go back. You know, there's a couple of things I want to talk about, and we'll get to both of them. But as long as we're talking about, like, you know, this movie and it's a Sean Baker movie and how things are not necessarily as conventional, can you talk a little bit more about some of the other unconventionalities? I mean, you know, Sean's famous for working with people who are, you know, not necessarily professional actors, bringing real people into it, being, you know, kind of finding things on the fly, doing this elaborate prep work that isn't necessarily, like, I assume that when you're doing the prep work and you're driving around and having a beer, you're probably not on the clock for all of that. But you tell me. I don't know. Maybe it's you know, extra 3 months of prep is. Tell me about the. Tell me about the unconventionalities. How is this different from working on a, I could really go different. I know that you also shot part of Outer Range, which I loved. And I mean, it's a huge difference from one to the other.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, you have to give your all to Sean. You know, it's like how I imagine people working with like Terrence Malick or something. You know, it's going to be unconventional. You're along for the ride, you know. You're not there to make sure it's like by the book and mm-hmm. and you know, like you're clocking every hour and like every this and that and that. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are some people doing that, but we all, you know, it's like making a movie with like your friends, really. Like Sean is not. He's a very close collaborator. He's more like a friend at this point and someone that I deeply trust and respect. And I don't look at it like as a job when I'm working on a movie with him. It just feels like we're making art along the way, like 100% on the way. Like it's just art. So we're all and he really trusts everybody, you know, his collaborators, and you're all truly giving your all to make a piece of artwork with him. So it's a real privilege and honor and just it is unconventional in so many ways. I mean, like, one of the reasons you don't really prep in a normal way as well is that things change all the time, and Sean is so willing to just follow a lead and follow something that's better and change everything and then rewrite things. Like, we discover something's better on set, like, we'll just pause and he'll rewrite it and the actors will have to learn it right there and then. Or he'll go home at night, he'll rewrite, like, you know, 15 pages, and then the actors in the morning have to, like, learn the lines and we have to reconceptualize it, and it might slow some things down, but he's a true artist and he's responding to what's happening. If you're making a film and you're not responding to the previous day's work, especially like, for instance, the home invasion where we're shooting it in chronological order, and things happen, you know, like a character reads a line a different way and all of a sudden it opens up like, oh, maybe that character is a little bit more like this. And then you have to rewrite some of that character's lines or things like that. Like it gives us a lot of freedom. Like the films are also very small. Mm-hmm. The crew is small. The footprint is small. It gives us like ultimate freedom to be able to pivot. We had an amazing dailies colorist, Adam Moore, and he did a great job. We and our colorist Alistair Arnold, we made a great LUT for the movie, like based off of tests we did in LA where we really dialed in the look, and we used that Lomo zoom and kind of in a way almost like accidentally underexposed some of the dailies or some of the tests, and we really liked where that was going, so that kind of became the look of the film. And
were you getting them daily? So like, and were you able to project them, or was it like, is so different for every production, but I know film in particular, it seems like dailies become like weeklies. They become.
Yeah. You know, they're late for sure. Yeah. But I love to bring the little iPad to set and like show the crew and get them excited, you know, and be like, man, look how awesome this shit came out. That was really hard, you know, but hey, it was worth it. Look at this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sean, I don't think Sean really watches dailies. I don't particularly watch dailies that much either. I mean, if I'm worried about something, I'll watch it. Or if they flag something, I'll watch it. But otherwise, I look through the stills and I'll grade some images here and there, or regrade if I need to. But I try not to obsess over that too much.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Let's jump back in time a little bit. Tell me about, you know, where did you get the bug? How did this start for you? I know you said you went to film school in Texas. Take us back to the early days of Drew, you know?
The early days of Drew. I'd say what really sparked my interest would be skateboarding. I mean, I filmed skate videos with my friends. That was my life, every single day, filming all day. But I was also skating. I wasn't just filming because I was really into the skating part of it, even more than the filming part. But it was, you know, you're just around a camera every single day, all day. You learn a lot about images. You know, you learn a lot about how to track, how to follow and how to track and how to operate the camera and read people's movements and know how people move, you know. I think it's something that you really have to work hard at. But I was just able to kind of get – I was able to do it a lot just because that was my life. I had to go to school, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do in school. And our University of Texas had a really great film program. And it was just by my luck, it was a very sort of DIY film program, you know, like Robert Rodriguez, Richard Linklater.
Sure.
These are the people that, you know, came out of our school, you know, so it was these like indie minded people, DIY people. So I think it just was a good fit for me. And I got onto a film set as a young dude. I was gripping, and I just fell in love with the family that you create when you're on a film set. It just felt like something I really needed at that point, and it just felt like this fifth circus family of weirdos, you know. And I was 100% in love with it. And then I started noticing the camera department and the cinematographer, and I just gravitated towards that. It seemed like that was the best job on set. And then I learned about how to watch movies and how to understand movies and break them down and understand the language of them. And I just became obsessed and kind of became that dude who just shot everybody's films in my class. You know, I was shooting everybody's film one, film two, projects on 16mm. And I started shooting some grad student films and just kind of made a little name for myself at my school, which honestly, the most important, I think, thing that I got out of all that was a boost of confidence, which I think you really need to be able to make it. And I got the compliments. I got people wanting to work with me. I got the teachers. Actually, I had a professor who I shot a film for him, and then I ended up shooting a feature for him. Mm-hmm. You know, right out of film school from my teacher. So just like those little things, you know, those little boosts of confidence, those little milestones that happened for me pretty early were just from me doing like my super indie DIY thing. And I always had a penchant for like, you know, natural lighting and indie films. I remember my professor was like, "Drew, everything you shoot looks like Gummo." he's like, "Not everything needs to look like Gummo." I'm like, "Well, that's just what I like."
One of the things that I want to ask you about, because
it seems like you're very flexible and you're able to work in all of these different sorts of scenarios and work in these, you know, kind of roll with the punches. When you're working on a bigger production, when you're working on a big television series, when you're working on stuff that is, can be extremely regimented and extremely, you know, you're on a schedule, you got to make the day. There's a lot of logistics involved, and a lot of the art sorts of, a lot of the art aspects of it, it's, it can be easy to fall into more of a paint by numbers than it is to, I think, fight for some of the art. At least I've heard this from talking to other people over the hundreds of interviews that we've done. So, tell me a little bit about the logistical aspects of it. Tell me a little bit about the unsexy side of being the DP, the non-art side. You know, how does that integrate into your life, or how do you choose to do it? Do you try to delegate some responsibilities to other people, or you know, you got to lead the camera, the lighting, the grip department. You have to be aware of all of the schedule types of things and make sure that gear arrives, and you have to navigate the waters of you know, human relationships and interactions and dealing with all of the people above the line and below the line. You end up being this nexus as the DP. Tell me a bit about like how you deal with that. What's your secret?
Oh my God. Just you listing it all like that makes me want to barf. Makes me not want to do it.
But that's, I mean, that's
what's so refreshing. Yeah. It is. It's what's so refreshing about working with Sean, because you're like, you're operating, you're flying by the seat of your pants, but you're also like the leader of this little like ragtag army, and it's very passionate. You know, it's so. I'd say the way I get by on bigger films is, I mean. Yes, I have to prep a lot on those films. I do. But also on TV, I have to say, like, you do a lot of the prep up front, and then once you're shooting, you're almost just rolling right into it. Sometimes you don't even get to prep that much. If you're shooting the whole show, you don't get to prep. You prep the first episode or two, and then you just roll with it, you know? And so there's something kind of fun about that. So you are using some of those same muscles that you use on, like, indie films, you know? And I feel like no matter what I shoot, I'm going to be using those same muscles. Even on like Outer Range, there was a bit of that. And the most fun I had on Outer Range is like, you know, if you look at the beginning of the show, as opposed to like, I shot a couple episodes from the beginning, and then I shot 7 and 8. And 7 and 8, I loved. It was so much fun. And I got to spend time with the director. I had a director who also had a very strong artistic vision and artistic integrity. And we were able to do something pretty cool with it. We shot fast, and we shot only what we needed. We never hosed it down with like three cameras. We never did any of the stuff that sometimes we did earlier in the season, just because we had a director. It came from the director, you know? Mm-hmm. And we shot with so much intention, and we'd shoot a scene in a one-er. We'd shoot a scene in like a one-er and then a close-up, and we're out of there. We're moving on. It was just so much fun. So I guess what I would say to answer that question overall is you have to build that stuff in from the beginning, the way you want to work. Like if you do want to work in a more intuitive, chaotic style, you kind of have to build that in. The producers have to know it. Like the director has to, you know, everyone along the way, it has to be on board. And the crew, you cast your crew accordingly, like to their strengths. You know, are they good at flying by the seat of their pants? Do they need to know days out or weeks out what's coming up? You know, like, I don't know. I try to like just be very forthcoming with what it's going to be and build that into the film as much as possible. And I also do. I love to inject a little bit of chaos into circumstances or scenes. Like if something is like, for example, you're doing this big one-er and everything is very choreographed and everything is dialed in and perfect, I'll try to throw something in there to just kind of screw it up a little bit, you know, because like things feeling overly choreographed and perfect, they lose a little bit of the humanity. So like I like to try to bring a little bit of the like human element back to it. The feeling of a person behind the camera reacting, and maybe they're a fraction of a second behind on a thing, you know, and you get to it a little bit late, or you land a pan and it's not quite right, but you just commit to it. You know, I like a little bit of those things that happen almost by chance or by a mistake, you know, so.
Drew, arguably, this is the highest profile and most acclaimed project you've done so far.
It's very inspirational for me to see that, like, my work is meaningful for people, you know.
Drew, this has been a delightful conversation. I really enjoyed, you know, chatting with you about your work. Congratulations on Anora. I know it's in theaters right now. People can go see it. They should go see it, which is great. Are you online somewhere? Can people follow you? Do you Instagram? Do you have a website? Do you have any of those things? Where can people find you if they want to look you up?
Yes, you can. I'd say, honestly, the best way these days is people have just been reaching out to me on Instagram, and it's just my name, Drew Allen Daniels, A-L-A-N. Drew Allen Daniels.
All right. Well, Drew, that's going to do it for us.
All right. So that was Drew Daniels. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Great work. And we will see you at the Oscars. I'm calling it.
Yeah. I think that being prophetic right now is not a bad thing. We're in the midst of awards season, and I believe that Anora is going to get a lot of love.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there's other movies coming out right now, but Anora has got some steam behind it. So
it's always interesting this time of year because, like, you know, we're seeing all these movies that are kind of, you know, being set up to win Oscars, and some of the and to me, this is one that has kind of an aura around it. Like, I feel like it. You know, far be it for me to say what will win. I think last year it was kind of obvious what would win, but you know, it's not hard to call that. I think this is going to get nominated for a bunch of stuff,
for sure. And I'm yet to find someone who told me the movie didn't work for them, didn't work at all, they didn't like it. And I think that's a really good sign. Like, when I talk to people who went and saw it in the theater and I ask them what they thought, I haven't heard anyone give me a negative review yet. I'm sure there are people out there who didn't like it, but I'm just saying I haven't met them. So
yeah.
That's anecdotally, that's going well. All right, so Ben, it is time to pay the bills.
Yay.
We got to thank our fine friends over at Aputure, makers of all kinds of lighting equipment for cinema, for television, for the web. They have a really cool product called the Infinibar, and the Infinibar is sort of like a metamorphosis, an evolution of tube lighting, which of course was popularized by some other companies, but the Infinibar is linkable. They're available in 1 foot, 2 feet, and 4 foot versions. And they have, I think there might even be maybe it's an 8 foot version, or maybe it's just the 8 foot is just two bars linked together. I'm not sure, but there are so many configurations of this and so many kits that you can create what are very, very large, wrappy sources for humans, which is great. And it's a soft quality of light, but it also has configurable pixels. And it's a very, very clever Lincoln Log Lego block interlocking system.
You call them Lincoln lights. They missed it. They missed it right there.
You can put them into ring light configurations, triangular configurations, strip configurations, and of course they're all compatible with Aputure's Citus Link, which gives you wireless control from a phone or from a tablet. And if you are looking for something that is not like everything else and want something relatively small and transportable, it's tough to beat the Infinibars. The Infinibars are really good. Now, not to be confused with Infinimat, that's another product they have, but Infinibar is really cool. So, of course, you can check them out at Hot Rod Cameras. Hot Rod Cameras keeps them in stock. We have a couple of the larger kits there, and you could light an entire show with just Infinibars if you so chose. I'm not necessarily advocating that.
On your iPhone. Anyway, go on.
It's an incredible versatile tool. Yes, you know, mark my words, someone's going to do like, oh yeah, I shot a movie now with the iPhone and like two Infinibars, and voila, that was the movie. And maybe it'll be brilliant, because ultimately I always advocate you use the right tool for the job, and the Infinibar is the right tool for a lot of jobs. It's worth checking out if you are unfamiliar with it.
And now, Short Ends.
Okay, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions. It's whatever is interesting to you right now. It could be a rant, could be a product, could be a form of art. What are you about with your short end this week?
I mean, you know what it is, because you were there too.
Okay, so good, because I get to fight you on this a little bit, because your opinion and my opinion differed on this thing then.
It is a movie. By a guy who I'd say I'm kind of friends with. He's a director, Stephen C. Miller. He's a super nice guy. He's made, this is I think his 15th feature film. It's called Werewolves. And it is, as promised, a movie about werewolves. Holy crap.
Wait a second. There's a werewolf in a movie called Werewolves?
Yeah. You know, I mean, like sometimes sometimes they'll throw you for a loop. So this movie is basically The Purge with werewolves. The basic premise is that there was a supermoon a year ago that caused anyone who was exposed to moonlight to turn into a vicious, like, hulking 10 to 15 foot monstrous werewolf and go on a murderous tear. And the supermoon is returning. Our main character, played by Frank Grillo, is a microbiologist but with a former military background who's working
as a common you know configuration. A lot of microbiologists are also trained mercenary military killers.
Since the James Bond movie where Denise Richards played a nuclear physicist.
Christmas Jones. Yeah.
have I less believed in the profession, but it does not matter. Frank Grillo versus basically an army of werewolves. Just an army of werewolves. Infinite werewolves. Shot by
8 foot tall werewolves.
Yes. Yeah. Shot by Brandon Cox, who gives it a whole lot of lens flare. Like a J.J. Abrams amount of lens flare.
Oh, no. Oh, you're being untrue there. J.J. Abrams wishes he could have that much lens flare. There is way more lens flare than J.J. Abrams.
Lots of lens flare. For me, especially during this season where it's like we're seeing all these prestigious films and there's nothing wrong with that. Love them. Anora, beautiful, wonderful film. There's tons of great films. They give you the feels, but Werewolves is just like a big,
gives you the feels.
A big fun monster movie that is in theaters probably as you're hearing this. I think it's going to eventually be on Peacock. I think Universal picked it up for streaming, and it is just giant dumb fun. I had a grin from ear to ear basically the whole movie, and I will see it again.
And so I can attest to that. You did. I've rarely seen you so happy in a movie. You were so happy.
I was at a birthday party with my son this weekend, and they had a trailer that was nothing but video games. And I kind of stuck my head in and watched all the kids in there and thought, I'm incapable of the kind of joy that these kids are having. And then it occurred to me that I saw Werewolves this week. And I was like, no, that's the kind of joy. Like, it's just, I wish every movie just delivered the goods like this. And it was, you know, just a big, goofy, dumb blast that knew exactly what it was and gave you exactly what you showed up to watch. So okay. Your retort is?
My retort is that I feel like there needs to be another genre or a name for movies that are not trying to achieve beyond their station. Everyone's aware of what they're making. Everyone is conscious that this is something that's a little bit campy, something that is a little bit, you know, following tropes of genres, but it's not parody. It's not parodied. It's not like, you know,
that's not winking at you.
Yeah. It's not a, whatever the scary movie, or it was a scary movie that was like mocking Scream. It's not supposed to be, you know, an airplane. It's mocking genres, but I feel like Hallmark movies do this. Hallmark movies all really much lean into tropes.
Yeah.
And they lean into like, hey, it's a Hallmark Christmas movie. You know exactly what you're getting, and they're not going to stray away from that. And I think there's a comfort in that. Werewolves is that for a particular, you know, a particular horror comedy genre, but the comedy doesn't come because the characters in the movie are telling jokes. The comedy comes from you can't believe what they just said, which fits so perfectly into this genre that everyone is totally aware of what they did. And they play it for absolute straight. They play it for serious value.
Frank Grillo isn't exactly the actor that you go to for self-referential comedy. I'm sure he could do it, but like that's not what he's known for.
All right. So my question to you is then there should be a name for this. People should know that that is what they're in for. It doesn't seem right to me that I have to do like a 5-minute explanation of what it is that we're seeing. There ought to be like a genre classification. Like, you know what you're getting into with camp. Yeah. Okay.
It's pulp. This is pulp. This is like imagine like the old pulp novels. If you're reading like a hard boiled detective novel in like the 1950s or whatever, you know, it's like, you know, the writers are paid by the word, and, you know, and it's, you know, leaning in, it's giving you what you want. When you bring up the Hallmark thing, I think actually that's a fine example of, like, if you want to watch all the Hallmark Christmas movies are the same. And I'm sure that the people who approach them would poke me in the eye and tell me I was an asshole for saying that, but there's a formula to it. Now, he's not having to adhere to a formula because it's not like we've had 400 werewolf movies like we've had 400 Hallmark movies in the last 10 years.
Christmas movies.
Yeah. So you know, like, but he's aware of what we're used to seeing in, you know, American Werewolf in London or The Howling or Dog Soldiers, etc. And really, I can probably count on that many fingers. What was that, 3, 4? Like, there haven't been that many super cool werewolf movies. I mean, like, you're not saying you didn't like it. You're saying, you know,
I'm saying you're
not going to get any smarter watching this movie.
No, and I was expecting, like, maybe a more traditional horror film, not the sort of, like, over-the-top, you know, pulpy, to use your word, but I don't know if pulp is exactly the word I would choose. I mean, yes, it is fitting, it does work, but there is like an extra element to it that I can't quite put my finger on, because there are other genres that are pulpy, but they don't lean into it in that same sort of way. This, I feel like, I'm not going to solve it on this podcast, but I feel like there is something about the intentional humor that, like, you know, you could have a pulpy detective novel that is played straight. You could have a Double Indemnity, mm-hmm. which definitely knew, like, what came before, but still just said, we're going to master this genre. We're going to figure out the best way to possibly do it. And Werewolves does absolutely fine at what it's trying to do, but it's not, and you're going to argue with me, I wouldn't call it high art. It's not going to win the Academy Award.
It's not high art. I guess, you know, it kind of comes down to this question of what's more important, high art or just entertainment value. And sometimes I felt like as a filmmaker, yeah. I would rather make a cult movie than a great movie, because how many Oscar, you know, best picture winners do we know? When's the last time? And I'm not casting aspersions on any of these films.
Oh, no, not at all.
When do we talk about The Artist, or when do we talk about The King's Speech? But we'll talk about The Thing all day long, or Big Trouble in Little China. These movies are maybe not. They're going for a different thing. I mean, Big Trouble in Little China, I think, is a film kind of like this, where it's just like, I'm giving you the weird goods, you know?
Well, maybe there ought to be a new category for cult or something that you know, I mean, at least the Golden Globes do try to get into a genre sort of split sort of thing there. Yeah. But I mean, maybe it's worth recognizing stuff that doesn't get recognized, and maybe something like a cult film would make a lot of sense. Anyway, you and I are not going to solve it on this call, and time is short, so we should probably get to my end and then get out of here, because I know you said you had to be on an important call right after this.
I do.
So here's the thing. I saw A Complete Unknown this past week. Mm-hmm. And I saw A Complete Unknown the night before I saw Werewolves. And A Complete Unknown is fantastic. And I talked to Faden about it last week too, and that episode's going to be coming up really soon, so I can't wait for everyone to hear it. But one of the things that struck me about that movie is it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it does not feel like 2 hours and 20 minutes. That movie goes really fast. And I'm not a big Bob Dylan fan. I can't say that I own any Bob Dylan music. I can't say that I've ever sought out Bob Dylan at all. The movie completely works, and I completely buy into it, and I love the story, and 2 hours and 20 minutes did not feel long to me at all. And what was funny is, as I was leaving the theater, someone was wearing a hat, and that hat had the MAGA font on it. It wasn't a bright red hat. It was like a more subdued gray, but it said, "Make films short again." Which I thought was a very, like, apropos sort of, like, statement about the length of movies lately. Eh. And so many movies, you know, they pass that 2 hour mark, and a lot of people are like, why am I still watching this movie? What is it that you're giving me extra? And I'm not gonna name a bunch of movies, but there's been some really bloated movies over the last few years, and I don't think that guy's sentiment about wanting movies to be shorter is unjustified. So I think that I really wish, and this goes for streaming services, this goes for anything that's being made for television, goes for what's, you know, being made as a quote unquote short film. if it is a schlong, if it is something that is supposed to be short and it is long, or something that is long.
I don't know that really schlong is the word I would use. Anyway, go on.
That's the right word for this. I'm okay. Really sure that it is. And anyway, my point is this. Things should only be the length that they should be. And I really wish that the mindset should always be, is this the absolute shortest it could possibly be? And I feel like there is so much indulgence that goes on, maybe at the studio level of people not wanting to cut down what's there. You know, if you really want to have a director's cut, you want to have that 4-hour version, fine. But the version that people should enjoy should have some limitation, and it should not just be completely open-ended. There is a way to tell the story in an appropriate period of time. And if it's 3 hours, great, that's 3 hours, but you ought to be making it so that you feel like it's a really great short 3 hours that, holy crap, you wanted more. I should always be left wanting more. I felt like I wanted actually a little bit more with, A Complete Unknown. So that to me is in some ways the highest compliment you can pay a filmmaker, because like after 2 hours and 20 minutes, I don't want to be like, you know, racing for the door. And so often lately I have been. And so for me, you know, my short end, I guess, is like reasonable run times. I really hope that, all filmmakers out there are always striving, number one, for the reasonable run time. I mean, because you want to make me love a movie, leave me wanting more of it.
My feeling about that is always like, you've got my attention for 90 minutes and you have to earn it after that. And, you know, I'll see movies like The Substance, which I think was 2 hours. It was like 2.5 hours long. And I never once wanted it to end, you know. Could anything be made shorter? Of course. But, like when I saw Wicked, I felt like Wicked is 2 hours and 40 minutes long. And it's like, could I make it shorter? Yeah, probably. But yes. But honestly, I was never bored. I was never checked out. I was with it the whole way, you know.
I can't say that for myself. I could have used 10 minutes less of Wicked, I think.
So. But that's really not that much in the grand scheme of things.
It's not, but I think it would have been a better movie. I think it could have been a better movie. Anyway.
I think so, it's awesome. Anyway.
So Ben, where can people find you? They want to track you down.
You can find me at benrock.com, and also find me at Neptune Salad on Blue Sky. I've been very active on Blue Sky, and I have to say this, probably some of the best engagement I have seen on any social media platform ever. Like, it's weird because it's not driven by an algorithm, to my knowledge. I think this is just what happens when people talk to each other online. Anyway, where can people find you?
Not on Blue Sky yet, because I've never been there once. But boy, now that you're talking about it, maybe I'll check it out.
We got to get the podcast on there. Anyway, go on.
Okay. You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. I'm also on the LinkedIn and the Instagram. Been reached out to by a few people lately on Instagram. So, I don't always check my messages as frequently there as if you were to just email me, Ilya@hotrodcameras. That's where most people get a hold of me, but it does happen. So, track me down. Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible today?
As always, Alana Cody. Holy crap. She's working her ass off right now, getting us all these amazing interviews. I just had a screening come up today that I have to go to for a film that I've been dying to see, and a cinematographer I've been dying to talk to for years. So that's very exciting. We have to thank Michael Dispenza, who the last time we talked, I was like, I think I've met him, but I'm not sure. Anyway, at Customer Appreciation Day, I had a nice long chat with him. And also, he was the one who handled the raffle and gave me my wonderful red paperweight. And
nice.
And lastly, Kay Zalatracci, who composed all the music. You can check him out at musicbykays.com. Give him a call. Hire him. He'll compose your stuff.
Fantastic. All right. So, Ben, that's going to do it for us. You want to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in.
I'm in. Very pulpy of you. Well done. Yeah.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.